Tomorrow morning, Cleveland will inaugurate a new mayor. He happens to be a Negro. His election happened to have been one of national significance. But it marked the first time that a man of his race had been elected to a major office in a great American city. Mr. Stokes' campaign had in it elements of high American drama, because it pitted the son of the slums and the grandson of slaves against the son of wealth and the grandson of a president. And it had, for those who are romantic about our American dream, a very happy denouement, in that his election offered proof again that this land is a land of wide opportunity, that a man can come from the very bottom rungs of the ladder to the top of his community. And for many of us, this was a welcome reminder, because the headlines have been black, and the speech has been violent, and we seem to have been making very little progress recently in breaking down the high color wall which has for the generations separated the races. Stokes' victory was one other evidence to us that there were at least some toeholds in the wall that the more nimble could clamber over, that a man, a Negro, could become a member of the Supreme Court or a member of the Senate or a mayor of Cleveland. And this was good, good to know, because the color wall remains high and the vast majority of Negroes are denied the rites of passage. The wall is not insurmountable, and that, I suppose, itself is a sign of some progress. But all events are enigmatic and all victories are paradoxical. And so though Mr. Stokes' campaign on the election on the one level marked a breakthrough in the American dream, a restatement that this is a land of equal opportunity, on quite another level, it signaled the breakdown of part of the American dream. A dream which speaks of a community as a group of neighbors and neighborhoods of many races and of many ethnic backgrounds and of many faiths living together under one governmental umbrella. Two elections ago, 35% of the electorate in Cleveland was Negro. In this election, 38%. By 1970, 40%. The white exodus continues from the center city. The high walls of real estate and rental restriction remain. True, a trickle of Negroes can leave the iron belt which surrounds the eastern east side ghetto, but most cannot. And demographers tell us that by the year 2000, almost every one of our great cities in the United States will be what they call a Negropolis, a large black concentration surrounded by clusters of largely white suburbs. The housing gap, the geography of housing has widened. The separation has widened between the white and the black. The hope that we would over the years come closer and closer together is vanishing more and more. There is a center city, carefully gerrymandered so that it excludes the more expensive, the whiter suburbs. There are the suburbs where people use zoning and housing restrictions and all manner of connivance to keep out the undesirables, in quotation marks. And finally, there are the new counter cities, the new towns being built here and there around the country for carefully selected people, where the riffraff and the ragtag and the rabble The words are all pejorative, and they are used by the people who keep out people on these terms and those terms, where the new mass is not welcome. And so in one sense, Mr. Stokes' campaign must be understood as simply the declaration by the increasing Negro minority, majority in our cities, that we will govern ourselves. You do not want us? At least we will assume control over our own destinies. For every Carl Stokes who has fought his way into the establishment, there are today a half dozen Negro militants, young men, able men, who say we want no part of the establishment, who have been so often put down and pushed off. They have given up any desire to join hands in common purpose. One of the tragedies of Mr. Stokes' election, perhaps the only one, is that he comes to office at a time when the war against poverty and the attack on racial prejudice is running out of steam. 10 years ago, Americans were speaking of cooperative effort, of joining forces, of shared enterprise. The word was community, community responsibility. Just 10 days ago, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Mr. Gardner, spoke of American society as being increasingly abrasive. He said that every group wants only what it needs for itself and seems to have no care of how it can rub shoulders with and accommodate itself to other groups within the society. The extremists of both sides say, we want no part of community. We want what we want for ourselves, all or nothing, now. Men and women who looked upon the Civil Rights Crusade as difficult but romantic 10 years ago are now talking much more of law and order than of the necessity of protest. They've come up against the obduracy of hate, the obstinacy of human nature, the difficulty of dealing with those who have been denied and who have been oppressed. They have done, they have helped, and they have not been thanked, and so they have turned against. And few had reckoned with the inevitable concomitant of violence, the inevitable concomitant of violence to social change. And so, whereas 10 years ago this country seemed largely united except for extremist fringes, lunatic fringes at both sides, in its determination to achieve a homogeneous society, I sense that fewer and fewer are ultimately concerned today with this sacred purpose. That more and more are turning into themselves, living their own lives, asking not what they can do for the nation, but asking only that the nation protect them from ultimate violence. And the war on poverty, launched with such éclat, it's run out of steam. Governor Myrdal says that to attack poverty in the United States will take trillions of dollars. The government proposes a few billion and Congress refuses to vote even that. A recent survey, which many of you saw, estimates that it costs about $9,000 a year for a father and mother to sustain a family of four in any dignity in one of our great cities. The gap between the other America, the 30 million poor, and our America, the America of abundance, widens and grows perceptibly every week of every month of every year. For the poor are poor. There is inflation. There is the rising cost of living. There is less employment for the unskilled and for the semi-skilled, and the programs of retraining have not been launched with the size and the sweep which is required. Mr. Stokes comes to office at a time when the American dream is often stated, but whereby our vote and our action and our effort and our priorities of concern The dream is more often words, empty phrases, than a purposed reality. And I'm afraid that all too many in Cleveland have assumed that somehow by his election, we will solve all of the problems of the urban crisis, of domestic unrest, of racial antipathy, which have badgered and burdened American society, lo, these many years. Somehow Clevelanders, I feel, have invested far too much in the single fact of a change of mayors. He will somehow turn on the tap in Washington, and monies will flow for urban renewal, for job retraining, for our school systems, for all that we need. He will somehow, by his very presence in office, moderate the black militants, keep violence from our streets, and by the presumed moderation of his action, quiet the fears of the white militants, and prevent the tension between the races from becoming more exacerbated. We expect all things of this new mayor, the solution of all the vast national problems of urban living. And he cannot, being human, of course, deliver on this. We have seen these national problems in focus in our city. We have seen square blocks of our city convulsed in violence. We have seen square miles of our city reduced to rubble, to emptiness in the name of urban renewal, and never renewed. We have seen slums become mobile, the poor pushed out for an urban renewal that never came, pouring over into another area, which then becomes deteriorated and overcrowded, one slum becoming another and yet another. We have seen the problem of the dropout, the problem of the poor, the problem of the unemployed. We have seen the problem of waste. Our beaches are polluted, our air is polluted, our water is polluted, our streets are congested, crime rates are on the rise, all of the classic problems of urban life can be seen in detail here in Cleveland. And many of us, far too many of us, I'm afraid, assume that by a change of mayors, we will solve these problems. I think it might be wise this morning if we create a tally sheet, a tally of what the mayor can legitimately be expected to do with vigor and enterprise and decisiveness, and what he cannot be expected to do, what we must do for him, we, the citizens, we, the government. What can Mayor Stokes be expected to do for this city? He can be expected to bring new administrative energies to the city. He can be expected to appoint men of skill and vigor and youth. We've had essentially one administration for almost 30 years, and many men have grown old and comfortable in office and have kept on archaic ways and old habits. We can't expect the mayor, with his control of the ultimate appointments in the police force, to improve the difficult relationships between the police force and the neighborhoods, relationships which, in the case of the Negro poor, have almost created two enemy camps between the servants and those whom they serve. Cleveland is an archaic, outmoded enterprise. I had occasion this last week to read through the 29 greenback reports of the Little Hoover Commission of last year. Each of them details a city operation which is a generation behind the times. Now, with his power, we can expect the new mayor to update and upgrade the level of city operations. Of the police department, the Little Hoover Commission said simply, the police department is run in a way which is a generation behind standard procedures in police management. Of urban renewal, the city has lacked the manpower even to complete the legal work, the papers, on its first urban renewal project, Garden Valley, begun in 1956. And on and on and on. Now, of course, the mayor will need money. Men come at a high price. Salary levels must be raised. There must be a new status and a new dignity to the office. But this problem is within the competence of our new mayor. as it is within his competence to improve relationships with all the groups within our city. We have been governed essentially in the last 30 years by a combination of politicians and the cosmopolitan groups. The Negro group has been tolerated, but it has had to come hat in hand. No longer will a moderate civil rights leader be called an extremist. No longer will the clerics of the Negro community be kept waiting, cooling their heels in the mayor's office. We can expect and do expect the new mayor to listen carefully to all the communities which make up our city, and not just to the white community. And this can only make for improvement within our city. We can expect him to make clear to us the depth and the burdens of urban living. There are today in the United States 140 million out of 200 million Americans living in the city. By the year 2000, 290 million of 340 million Americans, almost 9 in 10, will live in our cities. And our cities are not ready for them. We lack the institutions, we lack the schools, we lack the roads, we lack the recreational facilities, we lack the clean air, we lack the clean water, we lack the amenities, we lack almost every requirement of dignity and grace in living. And we have, of course, the roiling problems, the deep-seated historic problems of poverty, of racial antipathy, of deteriorating housing, and the like. And a mayor has the requirement not only to sell his city, but to make clear to its citizens the depth of the problems that they face and the cost involved in solving those problems. We have tried to run our city on the cheap. Between 1940 and 1965, Americans actually decreased the amount of tax monies which they allowed their cities to take in from their pocketbooks and incomes. And you cannot run a city on the cheap. It's going to cost you 3 and 4 and 5 and 10 times more to run Cleveland if we want to run it with some concern for the quality of life which exists here. If we are dissatisfied with a city where those who live within its lines receive garbage collection, waste collection of non-burnables once a month, where only two neighborhoods have neighborhood health centers, where housing inspection is hit and miss, and by and large, totally inadequate. All of this the mayor can do, and if he is vigorous and determined, will do. But what can the mayor do about the 15.5% of those who live in the slum areas of the city who are unemployed? What can he do about the 40,000 school children in Cleveland who must be sustained on 73 cents a day? What can he do about the 2 in 10 in the big city high schools of the poverty tracks who drop out before they have the skills which would make them employable in our job market? What can he do about the plants which are outside the city lines and spew their dust into the air and their filth into our rivers? What can he do about the regional planners who draw highway lines through his neighborhoods, destroy what stability there is in order to make it easier for suburbanites to come into their offices and to leave to their grass-enclosed homes? What can he do about a city which must give in state taxes for welfare and education far more than it receives back in the state redistribution of monies? There are definite limits to a mayor's power. He can act effectively within the administrative limits, but if we expect him to solve the problems of the city, he must have active, energetic, committed partners in the state. And is our state committed to the welfare of the city of Cleveland? And at the national level, and has the war on poverty and the war against race on a national level been accelerated, been escalated with the speed and the drive and the thrust which we might wish? President Johnson said 2 days ago that it was bunk. The word is his, I don't usually use it. That it was bunk that we could both make progress in Vietnam and make progress in the war against poverty. But you know, The federal government has allocated to the cities less than $1 per citizen for the Mass Transportation Act. There's allocated to the cities less than $3 per person in the Model Cities Bill. The level of welfare, federal welfare, has actually decreased. 3 years ago, the Office of Economic Opportunity was offered nearly $3 billion, was actually appropriated $2.4. It's operating on $1.6 and will probably come out of this Congress with $1.2 billion. We can see it in our own city. I sit on the board of the Cleveland Office of Economic Opportunity. Last year, we canceled out 16 programs touching 40,000 lives because these programs cost $2.7 million, which were no longer available to the city. And these were not luxury programs. The basic program was one of literacy training for adults. There was a program of job training for high school dropouts. There was a program of maternity care and health care for teenaged mothers. There was a program of high school credits for adults who had not completed high school and gotten their degree. Now, we did not cut these programs out because they were unworthy or they had proved themselves to be misdirected, but simply because Washington had not made the funds available. Washington talks about a war of poverty, but really, in effect, what we have had is a probing action, demonstration projects, a beginning, and nothing more. The sociologists tell us that the war on poverty will require trillions of dollars. We allocate each year less than $10 billion. We hardly keep up with the growing population. And if you want to know the real limitations of this war upon poverty, take Operation Head Start, which is the most approved and widely respected of all of its programs. It's a program designed to provide preschool training for 4- and 5-year-olds who come from deprived homes where they have not been read to, where they have not been spoken to, where they have not been taught to dress properly, where they have not been taught hygiene and the like. Competent psychological and sociological surveys have shown that 1 in 2 children from poverty areas have no chance of success in school unless they receive this school-controlled, school-centered preschool training. There are today 7,800 youngsters in the city of Cleveland between the ages of 4 and 5 in the poverty areas who ought to be receiving Operation Head Start opportunity. 1,200 are. 1 in 5. And the reasons are not manpower, and not the lack of will on the board of the council. They're simply fiscal. The monies were not appropriated. And what is true of Operation Head Start is true, kal vachomer, how much the more so of all the other lesser popular programs. The federal government, because of Vietnam, has not accelerated in any degree its demands upon the Congress, and the Congress, because of the budgetary restrictions, because of the growing deficit, because it is spending 30 plus billions of dollars a year in Vietnam, is chopping and cutting back. And the result is a dismantled and dispirited machine, and one which is hardly a whimper of the war which we proposed to launch. Mr. Stokes cannot be expected in the years ahead to solve the problems for which he needs the help of the federal government, of the state government, of those who sit in the cabinets and bureaus of our big industry, of those who live in the far exurbs and suburbs of our city, unless he has the cooperation of all those elements which today impinge upon the well-being and the welfare of the community as a whole. And there is very little indication, I submit to you, that he will have, he or any other mayor, that he will have the unqualified support that he deserves. For this is a nation tragically mesmerized by ideology. We have very real problems. But in the political world, men still speak of federal projects as against participatory democracy, states' rights as against the federal monolith of the federal octopus. And they vote for projects not because they are needed, but because there is a neat political philosophy which they learned at their grandfather's knee, which was inadequate and archaic in his day, which they insist on carrying over into ours. This country has broken down more and more into a nation of ideologues, the new right, the new left, the old right, the old left. It matters not. The greatness of this nation was that we could face a problem and find ways within our political system, ways which included government, included private enterprise, and included the citizens, which could solve the problems. That was the greatness of the New Deal. But today, anything which smacks of federal aid to the communities or to a school system is anathema to some. Anything which is not handed over whole to the free enterprise sector is anathema to others. Anything in which there is not complete community involvement is anathema to still another group. And I keep wondering, why can't we simply find accommodations, ways of weaving together, subtly but realistically, all of these groups? Why must it be one or the other, here or there? We always had found accommodation and compromise to be the democratic way. But increasingly today, we are voting against it and fearful of it. And this is a tragedy. We need, I believe, to take a good look at our own involvement in the city. Most suburbanites, most of you, believe that essentially you can create a counter city. A city out there where there will be security and safety, and quietness and tranquility, and all of the amenities, and that you will be spared the violence and the turbulence of the city, and that is nonsense. Your attitude, my attitude, in a sense, toward the city is characterized by a piece of ground which we pass almost every day, the Shaker Lakes. The Shaker Lakes belong to the city of Cleveland. The city of Cleveland spends $6,900 a year to maintain the Shaker Lakes. Now, you and I can come down to Rockefeller Park or to the zoo or to the aquarium and be admitted. But woe betide the youngster with black skin from the center city who rides his bike up to the Shaker Lakes. A policeman will cruise by and tell him it's no trespassing. We've wanted all the advantages of the city, its opportunity, and we have built fences and walls and barriers and police lines, lest the city intrude upon us. And of course it does regardless. Our children speak the jargon of the city sidewalk. They dress in the models of the city street. The drugs that they use were born and spawned in the city. The suburb, the slums rule. And they spill over into our suburbs, do they not? We become the city, and the lowest common denominator of the city life becomes the common denominator of our home life and our children's life. And instead of joining together to raise standards, we allow all the standards to fall. So that the sidewalk of the slum becomes the standard of culture, of teenage culture in the United States. And you know, thievery and violence do not know city lines. The thief has a car, or he steals one, and he's more likely to attack your home than he is one in his neighborhood where he may be seen and where there's far less to be taken. We cannot escape the city. Let's join with it. It's to our advantage. The city the Bible describes as Ir Ve'Em, a city that is also the mother. For it is the city which creates the environment which creates the man. The city is what gives us our dignity or drags us down into our degradation. The quality of city life is ultimately the standard of the life of its citizens. The quality of the life in the city of Cleveland or of any other major city is certainly not that which any of us would wish. And so I believe that if we truly want to support the new energy, a new administration, a new start for this city, Then we must begin, each in his own way, to take an entirely new attitude towards the responsibilities of citizenship. Taxes are not citizenship. A willingness to vote major taxes for major services may be. It is not citizenship to go to a parent-teacher's meeting in a white suburb for your child. It is citizenship to encourage the school systems, the 34 school systems of this county, to cooperate so that on the one hand we alleviate urban alienation and on the other hand we eliminate suburban trivialization. It is not citizenship to complain about the mayor of Cleveland. It is citizenship to join in the politics which make for strength in this city. It is citizenship to see that you have representatives in Washington who are voting to enlarge the war on poverty, who are voting for civil rights legislation. It is citizenship to be joining forces to break down the misapportionment of power in Columbus. It is citizenship to see that by your vote, by your act, by your energies, by your awareness, you are helping America come of age. For this new age, 1960s and 1970s and 1980s, will demand entirely new formulations of governmental authority, of the private initiative, and of citizenship responsibility. Many things we have learned in the 1960s. We have learned that you cannot band-aid a city's problems and cure them. We have learned that we are in a period of urban crisis, and this crisis is mounting every day in its pitch and in its intensity as millions more pour into our cities. We are learning that if we want to maintain any kind of amenity in city life, we cannot simply keep sprawling over into acreage, to old farms and building little shacks there that will be the slums of another age. That we need institutions, and we need schools of quality, and we need recreational facilities, and we need new restrictions upon industry, upon where it may go and what it may spew out into the air and what traffic it may bring upon its streets. That we need mass transportation. That we need a new concept of police-citizenship relationships. All these we need. And they all cost money. And we need a new concept of welfare, not a dole as we've given in the past, but some kind of guaranteed annual income. And we need job training and job retraining, because by the end of this century, almost everyone who is employed today below the professional level will be technologically unemployable, unless he can be retrained, whatever skills he has. The cost is frightening. We will not be able to pay that cost if we continue in all kinds of foreign adventures which drain our treasury, drain our manpower. But we're a wealthy nation. We're the wealthiest nation the world has ever known. And if any nation can meet the problems of the urban crisis, then it should be this nation. Martin Luther King, a few days ago, right after the election, commented in much the same way that I have this morning, that Mr. Stokes will need the united support of the community. He signaled out the business and the industrial leadership. He used a phrase there from our Bible that unless we give him this new sense of support, this broadened support, he will be katzon latevach yuval, as a sheep led unto the slaughter. He'll be our scapegoat. Whatever he does will not be enough, and we will blame him for whatever be the failures. The blame he may incur. He is only a man, and he is untested yet in this office. But whatever happens in the next 2 years in this new administration, let us not blame the man until we have blamed ourselves. Let us not see his shortcoming until we are sharply aware of our own. And our own are many. We have not yet, each of us, come aware to what is required of urban American this century. We're not ready to pay the price, not even aware of the dimensions of the problem. We must, by our individual act, by our individual vote, by our civic energy, by whatever influence and leverage we may have in Columbus or in Washington, we must find the way to give these mayors of our cities, these men of a new age who represent the emerging classes, we must give them the support which they need, not only to do their job, but to do our job. For ultimately, we cannot escape the well-being or the lack of it of this city. If Cleveland continues to deteriorate, if the quality of life here becomes harsher, if violence becomes even more widely spread, if the quality of communication between people becomes even more attenuated and exacerbated, each of us will suffer. Each of us will pay the price. We'll pay the price in the lack of pleasure in our own lives. Violence will intrude upon our homes and upon our businesses and perhaps even upon our persons. The quality of schooling will inevitably affect the quality of the world our children inherit, which they enjoy or which terrifies them. What we do not do for some poor little group in the city of Cleveland. We do it for them and for ourselves and because it's right and necessary to do. Cleveland 1967 has an opportunity. Nothing more. It is not a breakthrough. There is an opportunity for greater things. We have a much needed infusion of new vigor in City Hall. Do we have the new infusion of vigor at all other levels of our community lives and at all other levels of government? Unfortunately, we do not. And that, dear friends, is our task. Amen.